This is my journey, inspired one story at a time. A library of leaders was created. It began as a journey to learn. As time went on, it began to grow. All it needed was a platform, and this podcast was created to listen, to inspire, to share. I am a storyteller, and this is my journey. Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I'm your host, Steve Anderson, and today's guest is Rich DeVinney. He is a best-selling author, leadership, and human performance expert. He is a retired Navy SEAL commander. He had 13 deployments over a 20-year career. Currently, Rich works as a keynote speaker, a facilitator, and consultant with Chapman Company, Leadership Institute, Simon Sinek, Inc., and is the CEO of Attributes, Inc. We discussed a lot how SEAL teams during their training provide understanding of how to build high-performance teams and relate that to business. And I really love how he explains how the brain science affects how we respond to uncertainty, anxiety, and fear. This was really an interesting and insightful conversation with a great person who I feel really gets what makes us all tick and try to understand why we do things and how fear comes in to push us in certain ways, and just a really interesting discussion. So I certainly enjoyed it, and I think you will too. So let's jump right in and listen to a great discussion I had with Rich. Hi, Rich. It's a real pleasure and an honor to talk with you today. Thanks for being on the program.
Well, pleasure is mine, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Now, you are an identical twin, and you're a Navy SEAL, or were a Navy SEAL, and your brother is a Navy pilot. Do you think you push each other hard to kind of reach those high accomplishments?
I think so. Now, I have to make a slight correction, or else he would get angry with me. He's a Marine aviator, a Marine pilot. When I know I always tease the Marines in terms of the Marines being a department of the Navy, but I have to correct. Yeah, he was a Marine pilot. He flew the Harrier, which is a Marine aircraft. But yeah, I think that our relationship it pushed us in not as much in a competitive way because they're fairly different pathways, but certainly in a way that we certainly lived vicariously through each other. He loved the fact that I was a SEAL, and I loved the fact that he was a pilot. And I think those different stories and types of professions allowed us to kind of live vicariously through each other and serve in some unique ways. So it was always cool.
Now, I'm married to an identical twin, so I kind of have an insider look at how twins communicate. And how did you two go about and seek your own identity, which is sometimes hard as an identical twin?
Yeah, what a great question. Part of me thinks it was in fact one of the reasons why I chose to go to the SEAL teams was unconsciously I was trying to seek my own identity. I've thought about that quite a bit because both my brother and I grew up wanting to be Navy pilots, and we both grew up wanting to fly jets, and that was our big plan. Even going to college and getting into NRRTC, that was still the plan. I had learned about the SEALs while I was still in high school, so it was a little thing kind of burned in the back of my mind. And I've often thought that even though the SEAL team decision had many different factors in essence and why I made that decision, I've often thought that part of that was an unconscious desire for us to break from each other, because it is a big thing. You grow up kind of sharing identities, which is especially when you're identical, it's an interesting phenomenon that not many people understand.
Yeah, and I think that gives some real insight. I mean, people that don't have identical twins have trouble finding their own identity sometimes. And so, what advice do you have to people? How do you find your own identity? How do you define that?
Wow, that's a good one. I would say that's a tough. It's a tough question, and it's a tough thing to find. But the key is in starting that journey and continuing that journey. And I think the idea would be keep your mind open, keep yourself curious, and try to ask yourself some introspective, tough questions in terms of what drives you, what inspires you, and what are those things that you really love to do. Try not to get influenced by others. This is where the competitive gene, the competitive attribute, I guess, sometimes runs in the way of this process, because sometimes our desire to be competitive steers us down pathways, I think, that put us into lanes, you know, and of course you can find your own identity in those lanes, certainly, but I think the idea of looking over your shoulder or looking over the fence at another and judging yourself based on someone else sometimes runs counter to finding your own self, your own self-worth, your self-value, and certainly your own identity. So I think people have to be very careful with that phenomenon, I believe. But it is a process. I'm not sure if there's any easy answer. I think it's a process of discovery. It's a process of journey, which is going to involve challenge, uncertainty, and stress, and sometimes pain, but certainly worth it if you can find it.
Yeah, and doing a little research for this interview, I read something that you said once, that you said that you weren't very competitive, which surprised me when you look at you know, what you accomplished in your life and in the SEAL programs and so on. I would think that a lot of those guys are real competitive.
Yeah, it's certainly a common belief that SEALs are all very competitive, but I think I like to break competitiveness down to kind of its elements and really what it is. I mean, you think about someone who really loves competition. Competition often, I mean, to have a competition, there has to be two sides. There has to be kind of a winner and a loser, and there have to be rules rules and structure inside of which you can compete, or otherwise it's not a competition, right? So that you can't judge a winner or a loser unless you have structure around which you can kind of define those things. And so the competitive mind, the person who's competitive, really loves that environment, loves the environment where one can kind of figure out, okay, what's the structure? What's the environment? What are the rules? And then how do I win inside of this system? And but the non-competitive mind is different. The non-competitive mind doesn't necessarily like those types of boundaries and those rules and those types of things that say, hey, these are the rules and how you have to do it, and this is how you win inside of that. And that's kind of how I am. I'm someone who has very little interest in that type of environment. I love breaking away into new environments that there are no rules, or I get to make the rules, or I get to break or bend the rules, right? And when you're in an environment where you break and bend rules, or an environment where there aren't any rules, you have to create the rules yourself, competition no longer becomes a thing, because you can't structure any type of winning or losing. And so what I say about the SEAL teams is the SEAL teams actually honor both polarities, because most high performing teams, in fact, need to honor both polarities. And I'm not talking about athletic teams, of course, but the reason why most teams do, and certainly the SEAL teams do, is because both minds serve a purpose. The competitive mind in a SEAL team can look at an environment that may have structure, may have rules, and say, how do I win in this moment or in this fight or in this mission? Okay, that's a really powerful distinction to have. But a lot of SEALs are non-competitive, which means they look at the problem or look at a mission or look at an environment and look at a completely different way to do it. How can we accomplish this mission and pretend there are no rules? I mean, what else can we do? And we have to remember, special operations itself was founded on this principle of doing things that other units couldn't or wouldn't think of doing, to frustrate, agitate, and in some cases sabotage the enemy in ways they could have never thought. And so it's almost like they were designed to bend and break rules, which takes often a non-competitive mind to do that. But I do want to honor both polarities. Both polarities are important in a SEAL team. And so there are certainly guys in the SEAL teams with me who were highly competitive, and they were very, very powerful and effective in that vein. And then there were some of us who weren't competitive at all. We were usually the guys who were saying, wait a second, what? There are no rules here. Let's think differently. So it really helps to have both.
Really interesting perspective. You know, I think our society, at least this is from a layman's perspective here, is totally fascinated and highly respects Navy SEALs. And I was surprised to hear, again, in doing a little research for this, that you identified yourself as kind of an average student and an average athlete, because the conventional wisdom would be, oh, my, these are the elite of the elite. And so what's your perspective on that?
Well, yeah, and again, I think this is another misunderstanding that people have about the SEAL teams, that, you know, because they usually think about SEAL teams in terms of athleticism, and it actually has very little to do with athleticism. Certainly, you have to be in shape, and certainly SEALs are in shape and fit and healthy, and in some cases, some are athletic, but athleticism also usually can be kind of genreed in some sort of sport or, again, competitive event. But what people understand is when you go to SEAL training, and this is BUDS, basic underwater demolition / SEAL training, the first thing they do, and it's 6 months long, by the way, the very first thing they do is take you down to zero when it comes to your physical capability. I mean, there's only so many push-ups you can do, no matter how in shape you are. There's only so many miles you can run. There's only so many things, squats you can do, whatever it is. They take you down to zero, and they throw you in the surf zone. They freeze you. They take you down to a position where you are at zero in terms of fitness, and then ask the question, okay, what can you do from here? And so what happened quite a bit was you'd have these people who'd show up, and they were some of those most fit people you've ever seen, you know, whether they were D1 athletes or whatever. And some of them would be their very first to quit. And it was because I think they just never – They were brought up in a world where fitness and athleticism was always predominant, and everything they did in that environment was to preserve their best fitness level ever so they could compete. And there's nothing wrong with that. But in the real world of special operations, you have to get down beyond your physicality. You have to get into your mind and say, okay, when things are really, really the worst ever, and when it feels like you have nothing left in the tank, can you still perform? And so so the idea of being athletic doesn't have much to do with being a great Navy SEAL. And again, I don't want to say that with a caveat. SEALs are still in shape. They are some of the most in shape soldiers out there, right? But that's just because the job requires that. When you're lugging around big heavy things, or you're climbing up ships, or do whatever, you want to be in the best shape you can be. But in terms of athleticism, it's really about what can you still do the job when you are at 10%, you know, versus do you have to be at 100%, you know? And the guys who need to be in the 90%, 100% range so that they can even just do the job, that's not the guys that the spec ops community is looking for.
Yeah, interesting. And why did you become a SEAL? I mean, it's a big feat. And then did you ever doubt that you'd make it during the process?
Yeah, I mean, the reason ultimately, you know, and again, I guess I could dissect several reasons. I think one of the biggest reasons ultimately why I decided whether or not I should be a pilot or a SEAL is because I said to myself, I didn't want to be a pilot and wonder if I could ever be a SEAL. I didn't want to be in my cockpit and look over at the SEALs and be like, I wonder if I could do that. And so for me, it was almost just like, I just wanted to see if I could do it. And it's, well, that, so that mixed with this idea that these guys were, I mean, they were like James Bondish in the way, and again, I joined in the mid 90s, and very few people knew what Navy SEALs were back then. So I was reading books and stuff. I was digging up articles and finding whatever I could on what Navy SEALs were. And everything was about this idea that these guys were in every environment, but they specifically came from the water and the ocean. I loved the water. I loved the ocean. I loved being underwater. I loved scuba diving. And so this idea that these guys come from the ocean and do their thing, and then they go back to the ocean, and they were just kind of seemed very badass. And so so that kind of drove me to say, yeah, I want to try that. And so and then to answer the second part, I mean, I went to training, and I don't think there was never any time where I thought about quitting, per se. There were some times where I was like, oh man, this is hard. Like, yeah, this is tough. I never really thought about quitting. And I think the reason is I would imagine that at almost every single Navy SEAL you ask, if you ask that same question, the answer would be the same as I never thought about quitting. And the reason is because you have to barricade yourself from thoughts that could go down a spiral. And when you're in that type of misery, even the slightest hint of that type of thought can spiral massively into suddenly you're ringing the bell, right? And so I think the guys who made it through, we all were able to shield ourselves and defend ourselves from even letting that thought enter our mind. I mean, yeah, I mean, listen, I might pass out right now because of exhaustion, or they may kill me, but there were times I literally said, well, they can't kill us, right? So I might as well just stay here. They have to, I mean, they're not allowed to kill us. I used to say that. I can tell you there were many times I said that to myself. I was like, well, they're not allowed to kill us. So I guess at the end of the day, we'll still be alive, right? So that means I could stick around a little longer. I think a lot of SEALs would probably agree with it.
So when you started, you said that the SEALs weren't that visible, but now they're highly visible. And it's kind of almost a romantic look at it, so to speak, in a way. And are the teams now, are they attracting the right personality to produce the best warriors?
Well, so the answer is two parts there. The question, because the first answer is, are they attracting the right people? And the answer is yes and no. There's probably a mix of people who they're attracting that are the right people and probably not the right people. The great news is that the selection process is sound and hasn't changed. I mean, other than gotten better in the last 60 years, right? So regardless if it's the right person, the selection process will vet out whether or not that person is the right person. And that's the beauty of SEAL training. I think the motivations have changed. And again, one could argue whether one motivation is better or worse than another motivation. But if we look at it just without any judgment, the motivation for most of us back in the 90s was we just wanted to be ghosts. We wanted to be kind of badass ghosts, invisible people, spec operators who did the job and disappeared and kind of were never seen. And that's really ultimately how most SEAL missions go, by the way, unlike Hollywood or the books would indicate. Most SEAL missions are ones that go, usually without anybody knowing you were there or really cleanly or whatever. But as the community gained popularity, which is really a very bizarre thing to experience while you're in it, you started to wonder, okay, are folks now joining because they want to be like this really famous type of badass, or do they want to, join? I mean, you can sometimes indicate, sometimes when you see guys, like, we all raised our eyebrows if we saw someone, they join the teams, then they get through SEAL training, and then they stay in the teams for like 2 years or something, and then they get out, right? That's when you start raising your eyebrows. You're like, I wonder why that person joined. I mean, again, most of my compadres stayed in for 10 years or longer, a lot of them 20 plus years. Some of them are still in, and they're at the 25, 30 year mark, right? That means that they're in it, because of the right reasons. But I would say most of us raise our eyebrows if someone gets in it. And even if they make it through, they're only in it for a year or two, and then they punch and they start, they're out there. And it seemed like, that seemed like more of a ticket to punch versus anything else. But again, the process doesn't lie. The process is sound. And even if that person does stay in for a couple of years, they're likely giving good service for that couple of years. They can do other things.
And I've often, I know that the percentage of those that start the process is very low, that who make it. And I've often wondered, with these high caliber people in the process, what happens to a SEAL candidate who doesn't make it? Does it affect their psyche? Does it affect their career going forward?
Well, it doesn't affect their career, because the guys who go through SEAL training are really at the beginnings of their Navy career, whether it's an enlisted or officer. You're talking about a guy who's really at the very beginning. And in fact, most enlisted guys, they haven't even done anything in the Navy. They've gone straight to SEAL training. They joined the Navy, went to boot camp, did whatever, and then they're at SEAL training, right? So those guys who, when you quit, those guys just get pushed off to the big Navy fleet. And the Navy says, okay, well, we'll make you do something else. So you become whatever it is. Officers, same thing. If you don't make it as an officer, you just go fill another officer role in the Navy. And there's no detriment to your record in that case. So from a career professional standpoint, there's nothing detrimental. From a mental standpoint, there certainly is something detrimental for many guys who don't make it, because no one shows up to Buds thinking they're not going to make it. Everybody expects to make it. So So they have implemented over the years, and there were some cases. There have been cases in the past where guys have committed suicide after not making it. And so the community has gone to great, and the Navy has gone to great pains and great effort to make sure that they mitigate the psychological effects of someone who quits. One of those things they do is that when someone quits, they basically go into a room, and they have to stay in this room with some instructors and just live there for at least 24, I think maybe 48 hours, so that they can talk to psychs and psychologists and things like that. They can make sure this person's head is okay before they let them out on their own. And that has done a lot for helping the psychological aspect. But there's no denying, you know, when someone dreams or works very hard to get to SEAL training, their intent is to make it through. And if they find themselves now having quit, there's some work to be done. Just to make sure that person understands that it's okay. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, and the percentages are very high, right? It's only what is it, 15% that start make it?
Yeah, between 10 and 15% make it. So you're talking about classes. I mean, typical classes, at least, and I could use mine as an example because it's very typical. We'll start in the 160s or so student body number, and then we graduate about 38, you know, so high 30s, low 40s. That's a very typical percentage of guys to make it. So yeah, so it's designed that way. It's always been designed that way. I mean, ever since Draper Coffin ran the very first Hell Week back in 1944, I think it was 43, 44, it was only 10% made it through that one. I mean, so it's always covered that same area, and the community's always done work to, and the Navy's always said, hey, is there any way we could up this percentage? And ultimately, the community's always said, well, listen, it's all about the experience. There's not much we can do to predict. This is why when we talk about things like attributes, experience is the environment are really the most accurate ways to draw these out, because you can't do it with an interview. You can't do it with questions. And so you have to put someone in an environment and see if they have what it takes.
Well, that's a perfect segue into what I want to get into next. So you've written a great book called The Attributes, 25 Hidden Drivers of Optimal Performance. And explain how attributes affect human performance.
Well, absolutely. Well, so performance, the thing about performance is that we often think of it only in terms of skills. Those things that we do, how well do you throw a ball or ride a bike or drive a car. That's how we typically think of performance. And what I had to do when I was in the SEAL teams and I was running a particular training program that we had, I had to kind of dive in and deconstruct performance and ask ourselves the question, wait, it has to be more than just that. And the reason why I asked myself that is because I said to myself, well, in SEAL training, buds, you spend hundreds of hours running around with heavy boats on your head, and you spend hundreds of hours exercising with 300-pound telephone poles and running around those things on your shoulders, and then freezing in the surf zone. And as I thought about my career, even up to that point, I had done hundreds of combat missions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and never on one did I carry a boat on my head or a telephone pole on my shoulder. Right, those two things were never present on any of my combat missions, which meant the training, the SEAL training moniker was actually not correct. They weren't really training us to be Navy SEALs. They weren't training us in those things to be Navy SEALs. They were putting us into situations in the environment to tease out these innate qualities, these attributes, to see if we had what it took. And so I had to break down the two. And so just a real quick breakdown. Skills are things that are not inherent to our nature. We're not born with the ability to throw a ball or ride a bike. And skills direct our behavior in known environments and known situations. So here's how and when to throw a ball or ride a bike. And because they're visible, and you can see them, they're very easy to score and measure and assess and test. You can put scores around, you can put stats around them. You can put them on resumes. The problem with skills is they don't tell us how we're going to show up in challenge, stress, and uncertainty. When the environment becomes unknown, it's very difficult to apply, if not impossible, to apply a known skill. And this is when we lean on these qualities, these attributes. Attributes, on the other hand, are more innate. We're all born with certain levels of adaptability or resilience or situational awareness. Now, certainly they develop over time and experience that can be developed, but we're born with these things. You can see levels of this stuff in small children. Attributes also don't direct our behavior. They inform our behavior, right? So my son's levels of resilience and, say, perseverance informed the way he showed up when he was learning how to ride a bike, the skill of riding a bike, and he was falling off a dozen times doing that, right? So they inform how we show up. And then because they're hidden in the background, they're hard to see. They're very difficult to assess, measure, and test. And you can't necessarily score them or put stats from them. And so you have to, the only place you can really see them very viscerally is during times of challenge, uncertainty, stress, when the real us shows up. And so these attributes are running in the background of our programming all the time. You know, whatever we're doing, whether it's comfortable and it's predictable, or in times of challenge, uncertainty, and stress, but they show up the most viscerally. So if someone, for example, is naturally impatient, that impatience informs the way they are performing everything else they're doing, you know, in all parts of life. But that impatience really comes to the surface when the environment becomes uncertain and challenging and stressful. That's when you see the impatience, right? You may not see it when that person's just working on their spreadsheet or something, but it's still there. And when we talk about performance, we have to look at both of these factors. And the book really draws out this idea of these attributes that we all have. And if we understand them, we start to understand our performance.
So we look, going back to the BUDS training then, it's really not skill, it's more attributes that determine who gets through.
Yeah, I mean, BUDS training is mostly a selection course. It's mostly BUDS is mostly a selection course versus a training course. And again, training is training skills, right? Now, you still do some training. In BUDS, you learn how to scuba dive, you know, and you learn how to shoot weapons. You learn some explosives. So there is some skills training involved in the 6-month BUDS course. But for example, you have three phases: first phase, second phase, third phase. Second phase is dive phase, and third phase is land warfare. So you're learning a lot more skills in second and third phase. That first phase, the fifth week is hell week. That first phase is pretty much all attribute selection, because all it is just kicking your ass and seeing if you can make it through, right? So you don't learn very much in first phase, right? So yeah, it's much more of an attribute selection course than anything else.
And then explain the difference between personality types and attributes.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think personality, as I looked at it, so I'm really interested in what I would call elemental human performance. So in other words, who are we at our most raw, right? Because we often hear the kind of that statement, hey, you know, it's when times get really tough that the real us shows up. Okay, well, I'm always like, okay, who's the real us? And I guess part of the curiosity came from the fact that I put myself in an environment for 20 years that really was all about showing the real you, because it was always stressful and challenging, right? So personality is kind of a bunch of things go into our personality, and your personality develops over time. You don't see the personality in a child until they're starting to get into the ages of, you know, 5 and 6, and you start to see the personality show up. And that's because the personality adds into the equation certainly attributes, but also beliefs and values and influences and things like that. All of those things go into a personality. And so I would say attributes is simply just an elemental piece of the personality. I'm really fascinated with, okay, what are those elemental pieces? So personality is good in terms of how we relate and how we show up, especially in normal everyday life. But again, we all can probably attest to the fact that when we are in deep challenge and uncertainty and stress, sometimes our personality doesn't necessarily matter, right? It's really those, we go back to those core things. And that's really what I'm interested in. That's how I kind of distinguish the two.
And then what attributes do you think are the most effective in business leadership?
Well, I mean, so business leadership is quite specific. And I actually have a section, you know, I write 5 categories of attributes in the book. And one of the categories are the leadership attributes. And so when we talk about leadership, first, a couple of things you have to understand. The leadership, being in charge and being a leader are 2 different things. And yet they get conflated all the time. One is a noun and one is a verb. Okay. Leadership is a behavior. And we also don't get to self-designate. We don't get to call ourselves a leader. That's like calling yourself good-looking or funny. Other people decide whether or not you are someone they want to follow. You can certainly call yourself in charge. You can declare, I am in charge. But whether or not someone looks to you as a leader is up to them, not you. And they make those decisions based on their behaviors. And those behaviors come down to some very core attributes. And those attributes, the leadership attributes, are empathy, selflessness, authenticity, decisiveness, and accountability. And the reason why those are kind of the core ones is because, and I've done work since I retired in 2017, I've done work with a leadership institute called the Chapman & Co. Institute out of St. Louis and doing work with my buddy Simon Sinek, who does a lot of leadership stuff, but, you know, been around the country and around the world teaching leadership and giving courses and seminars on leadership. And one of the things we always did, regardless of where we were, was that we'd ask the question of the audience, and we'd say, what do great leaders do? And then we just have the audience just shout out answers, and we just write those answers up on a whiteboard, and we'd come up with a list of, say, 20 or 30 things. Well, every single time we did that, first of all, the list was always the same, which is indicatory of the fact that we all know what good leaders do, right? It's no secret. The second, they were all behaviors, right? They were all things that people did, right? Things that they did that made us decide. And then third, what these five things were always on the list, and they were usually at the top of it. You know, empathy, selflessness, authenticity, decisiveness, and accountability were usually at the top 10 of things that people did that caused us to think of them as leaders. And so business leaders need to understand this idea that if you are in a business and you are in charge, if you want to be a leader, you need to behave like one.
Yeah, that's great. You know, it's interesting you brought up Simon Sinek. I think, you know, just from my observation, what he does so well is takes the complicated and makes it simple, you know, and really explains it in a very simple way. And he's kind of the master at that.
He is. He's been a great friend and a great mentor and influence, because I, you know, even when I was writing a book and I'd call him and say, hey, you know, what do you write? You know, give me some thoughts. You know, he's always allowed me to understand and desire to articulate things in a way that people don't understand. And especially coming from my background as a SEAL, I didn't want to write a Navy SEAL book. I didn't want to write a book that was just about SEALs and really how SEALs, you know, I didn't want to put SEALs up on a pedestal, you know, because I think when you put something up on a pedestal, and of course, there are some cool stories, and I'm not kind of besmirching anybody else out there who's telling stories, but in, you know, when if I'm trying to get information across that someone can relate to, putting myself or the SEALs on a pedestal is not going to be relatable. So a lot of people would, you know, a lot of guys who've written about SEAL stuff have approached the question, how are SEALs, how are Navy SEALs different from everybody else? And I think a lot of people wonder what the answer to that question is. I wanted to approach the question differently. I wanted to ask the question, how are Navy SEALs the same as everybody else? Because we are, in fact, all human, right? And so as humans, how are we the same? What are those things that can be the same? So the articulation of that and kind of some experience was really my goal for the book. And Simon was certainly an influence in terms of the way he's able to do that. I really endeavor to try to do what he does, because he is the master.
And I know that you're also a fan of Russell Acuff. Did I say that right, Acuff?
Yes, yes.
And what does he feel is the formula for a good team? Because essentially, if you are a leader, you need a good team behind you. So what's the formula for that good team?
Well, he did some great work on systems theory and management. He's deceased now. I think he died in the early 2000s. But he would often say a system is never the sum of its parts. A system is the product of its interaction. And honestly, the same goes with people and teams. The team is never the sum of its parts. The team is a product of the interaction of those parts, right? And this is why the dream team concept often fails, because dream teams are usually put together based on skills, you know, the best this, the best that, the best whatever. Let's put all these best things together, and we should come up with the best kind of group, right? But what we forget is that it's not about that. It's about how the interacted human beings interact with each other, and it's dynamic, it's unpredictable, it's complex. And so you have to put together teams based on attributes, because attributes, in fact, predict or inform behavior and performance in unpredictable, complex environments. And so it's all about the people. You know, every team is made up of people, and that's why attributes matter. And that's what I think Russell Acuff would have attested to.
You know, it's interesting because I think you also were in charge of creating specialized command teams within the SEALs, you know, which I think is made up of elite groups made of SEAL members. So at this point, yes. Are you just focusing on who works best together?
Yes. Who works best together? Yes. But also who has the attributes that are required for the specific job? You know, every job is going to require a different set of attributes. Okay. So in other words, the attributes that make up someone who can be a great Navy SEAL is going to look different than the attributes that make up someone who can be a great accountant or a great teacher or a great whatever you name the job. And so, you know, in our processes or in any hiring process, the first diligence to be done would be, what are the attributes that we need for this job to be completed? Now the job might and often will include attributes that allow them to be interpersonal and relate to other team members. But there are some, we can probably come up with at least half a dozen jobs out there that are fairly self-directed and don't necessarily require a lot of teamwork, right? Those jobs still require a set of attributes. And so it's about looking at what attributes are required for that specific job. And then in that vetting process, there are likely be attributes that relate to interpersonal relationships and can we get along in teams.
Now, in business or military teams, kind of explain what fear does to us and how we deal with it. You know, all about this parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system responses and so on. What does fear do, and how do we work on mitigating that?
Yeah, fear is interesting, and again, fear is designed by nature, right, to allow us to appropriately risk assess, right? And so that's why it's a good thing. Fear is a good thing. But what we need to understand about fear is that there's a lot of physiology that goes into fear, and there are usually reasons that spawn fear. And so, fear shows up with the combination of two specific things, uncertainty plus anxiety. So you have those both two, uncertainty plus anxiety equal fear, okay? Because you can have one without the other, and you're not necessarily fearful, okay? So you can be anxious without being uncertain. And that might be you're going to give a presentation to your boss next week, and you know your boss, you know the presentation, so you're a little bit anxious about it because you want to make sure you do a good job, but there's nothing uncertain about what you're about to do, right? So there's no fear there. There's just a little bit of anxiousness. You can be uncertain without being anxious, okay? Well, that's every kid on Christmas Eve, okay? So there's no fear there either. As soon as you combine the two, that's when fear starts to kick in. And fear, once that happens, we get the amygdala in our brain starting to detect threat, and we've all heard of the amygdala response. Our amygdala kicks in, and as that amygdala response rises, as we get more fearful, our conscious mind begins to start going offline, right? That's when we get what we call amygdala hijack, right? In other words, we're now our body, our brain is moving our body without us even consciously, making a decision. But there's a lot of time and space before that actually happens. And in that time and space, what we're really needing to do is try to buy down either one of those two elements so that we can better manage our fear. And by that, I mean, you buy down uncertainty, you can buy down anxiety, okay? Anxiety is the easiest thing to buy down in the moment, because anxiety, we have to understand, is all internally based. Our anxiousness, that response in our system, is all physiological, okay? So our breathing starts to quicken, our pupils begin to, dilate, and those types of physiological responses. Maybe our palms get sweaty, those types of physiological responses happen. So we can manage our anxiety by just simply working reverse of that process. So in other words, we can use breathing techniques to manage our anxiety, to slow down our breathing. We can use visual techniques to actually kind of open up and manage our anxiety. So as we do that, our conscious mind comes back online, and we can begin to then deal with the uncertainty. The uncertainty now is external. That's all external to us. So there's not much we can do other than to ask some questions about it. One of the questions that's often asked and should be asked is, what about this do I understand? Right? Because when you're in an uncertain environment, the first question you should ask is, well, what about this environment do I understand? And you'll generally come up with a list. It might be a small one, but you might come up with one or two things and say, okay, based on that list, what can I control in this moment? And then you pick something and you move to that, okay? And that's, in fact, how we can step through fear, because we can just kind of move through that question and answer process as long as we're managing our anxiety. But we have to understand that fear is there for a reason. It's designed to make us think and stop and assess the risk, because sometimes in the fight or flight response, flight is the right choice, And so we have to understand that too, because we don't want to be running into the gunfire without understanding what it is. So yeah, but we can manage our fear very easily, especially in today's world where there's not a lot of super high risk a lot of our fears is somewhat unfounded.
And one of those strategies, if you will, or whatever, is something you call chunking. So explain that a little bit and how that works.
Yeah, chunking is really this question and answer process. Okay, we're basically chunking our environment into that which we understand. So we're taking this uncertain environment, which might be 100%, and by asking questions about it, we're chunking it down to something we understand, which may in fact only be like 10%. Okay, but by simply asking a question, what about this environment do I understand? You suddenly get rid of all those other things that you can't affect, you can't control, right? If you can't understand it, if it's something you can't control, you shouldn't necessarily worry about it in that moment, okay? So asking questions allows us to chunk the environment into something we can understand and therefore control, and then we move into that. And what's interesting about that process is the courage circuit in the brain is simply the circuit that flips when you decide to step into your fear, right? So we have the fight or flight response. When you decide to fight, which means step into your fear, that courage circuit gets flipped, right? And you actually get a dopamine reward for doing so. And so we get rewarded for stepping into our fear. And that dopamine says, because it's a very powerful neurotransmitter, says, this is good. Keep doing this. Keep going. Which allows you to then ask the question again. Okay, now, what do I understand? What can I control? And you move to that. Okay, now, what do I understand? What do I control? And you move to that. Now, as you move through that process, that and you begin to understand more and make movements, that aperture of uncertainty, or excuse me, the aperture of certainty would begin to expand, and the uncertainty will begin to dissipate. You'll begin to understand the environment more and better until you can eventually move through that that entire environment, and then you're done. And you can look back and say, wow, that was interesting, and then you can reflect and learn on your lessons.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. The part of the book that really resonated with me, I love the part when you said, the difference between discipline and self-discipline. Talk about that a little bit and tell why someone like me thought, oh, thank God, someone understands me a little bit.
Yeah, this is a fun chapter, right? But also intimidating, because it involves some introspection on my part. And what I needed to do was I needed to ask myself, okay, is there a difference here? Because it wasn't lining up. Discipline overall wasn't lining up to what I'd experienced in the real world. And what I mean by that is I'm someone, for example, who I'm pretty good at like setting and achieving long-term goals. But when it comes to disciplining myself, I'm not that good. I'm weaker at that. And then I've met people who are extraordinarily self-disciplined, right? But in their entire lives, but they, when it comes to long-term goals, long-term success, they can't really do it, right? And so the way I had to describe it and kind of break it down was that self-discipline involves those things, those goals that you can choose to do that the external world has no say in, okay? So that would be you or me saying, okay, I'm going to work out or I'm going to eat healthy, right? We can make that decision, okay? And then the next day or the next week, we can be in Las Vegas at the buffet. The buffet is not going to throw pastries at us, right? It's all on us whether or not we continue to do that. That's self-discipline. There's things you can do that the external world has no control, has no say in. Discipline overall is those things, those goals, those objectives that you have that the external world does have a say in. Okay, that's things like, okay, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to become an Navy SEAL. I'm going to get to a certain position in my company. Whatever that is, right? The external world has a say in as to whether or not you do that. And the external world will. It is guaranteed, throw things in your way, throw blockages, throw hiccups, obstacles. And so to understand the two makes us start to, A, dissect how we perform, how we show up, but also understand, well, if I'm highly, highly, highly self-disciplined, oftentimes self-discipline requires structure, routine, and repetitiveness, right? Consistency. If you're highly self-disciplined, that means that you thrive on that stuff. Well, that means when you go into the discipline phase of a long-term goal objective, you can be guaranteed that the world is going to throw you out of your routine more times than you can even count, right? You will be thrown around, you will bounce around, bat around outside of your routine. Things will happen. You won't be able to, your routine will be blown out of the water most of the time, right? So that is often an uncomfortable position for someone who is highly, highly self-disciplined. On the other side, if someone's disciplined but not self-disciplined, right, that means they're really good with non-structure, and things happening. But if they are completely unself-disciplined, they're not going to do very well either, right? Because they're not going to be able to execute overall discipline. Any goal, any long-term goal is going to require an element of self-discipline somewhere along the journey. So obviously the best balance is to have both. And if you are, if you find you're someone who is much higher on one than the other, now you know which one you need to work on, right? You need to be very cognizant of that. I know for me, in achievement of long-term goals, I have to be more cognizant and more deliberate about this, those things that I discipline myself on doing, whether it's getting up at 4 a.m, you know, every morning to do writing or whatever, whether it's, you know, working out every day, whatever that needs to be, I need to make sure I'm more diligent about that. And that's kind of how we can approach this. And I think people can get a better sense of how they can overall achieve overall long-term goals with more effectiveness and success.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And what about curiosity? Is there a role in that in leadership and building teams?
I think there is. I deliberately left that out of the book because I was wrestling with curiosity versus cunning in terms of the drive attributes. And the reason why I left it out of the book is curiosity is certainly an attribute, but I didn't feel like it wasn't super, super necessary. You don't like have to be super curious to be an optimal performer. It's really helpful if you are, but the distinction is this: curiosity is kind of a proactive kind of desire to explore, find new things, try new things, you know, things like that. It's just really cool because you find yourself doing things that you never thought you would. Cunning, on the other hand, it has to do with problem solving, right? Cunning is a way to look at problems differently. There's almost like a curiosity, there's an open-mindedness to it, component to it, but there's this problem-solving component to it. Cunning involves this ability to look at a situation, a problem, and say, okay, let me ask myself, what are the rules and boundaries, and are they real or are they perceived? And if they're perceived, then I'm going to get rid of them, right? I'm not going to follow them. If they're real, I'm going to ask myself, okay, what happens if I break them? what are the consequences if I break them? And this is where cunning becomes very, very effective as an attribute versus just curiosity. Navy SEALs, I would say, one of the primary attributes you'll find is most Navy SEALs are cunning, right? Because again, to be a Navy SEAL, to be a special operator, you have to think that way. You have to think beyond the boundaries, whether they're preconceived, whether they're perceived, or whether they're real or not, right? And in the book, I give an example of this in terms of a medieval example of the princess in the tower, guarded by the dragon, right? And the king wants to save the princess. So every day he sends his best soldier, his best knight, to go save that, to slay the dragon so that they may save the princess. And every time that knight goes and tries to slay the dragon, the knight gets burned, right? Until the Navy SEAL shows up. And the Navy SEAL says, okay, sire, what's the mission? And the mission, the king says, well, I want to save the princess. And the SEAL says, well, who gives a crap about the dragon, right? And the SEAL says, well, the mission is not to slay the dragon, save the princess. The mission is to save the princess. And so the SEAL starts to think about ways to get to the princess that go around the dragon altogether, right? And so this is what cunning allows us to do. And it's the difference between just raw curiosity and actual cunning, which involves problem solving, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. You know, when developing high-performance teams, explain the role that humility and humor play in that.
Yeah, huge roles. First, with humility is somewhat self-explanatory because, you know, again, the arrogance will kill any team environments all day long. And because, you know, in any high-performing team, what has to happen is there has to be what I typically refer to as dynamic subordination going on. Dynamic subordination means that In a high-performing team, that team understands that the problems and challenges and issues can come from any angle at any moment. And when one does, the person who is the closest to the problem and the most capable steps up and takes lead, and everybody immediately follows. Right? And so it's a shift between leader and follower. It's a dynamic swap between leader and follower. I also call it alpha swapping, where it's constantly shifting. Who's leading is constantly shifting. Who's kind of taking up the charge is constantly shifting. And so to do that in a team, a team member must be humble, and by humble, I mean vulnerable about both their strengths and their weaknesses. They have to wear those things on their sleeves. They have to be able to come to the team and say, listen, here's what I got to give you. Here's what I'm really strong at. And oh, by the way, here's what I'm weak at. So you all know, we all see it, and know I know what I'm going to lean on you for, and you know what you're going to lean on me for. And that's where humility really plays a true deep role in the team building aspect. Humor is a very fun and necessary component of any high-performing team. And I say I've never met a high-performing team or experienced a high-performing team that doesn't have some humor, or at least what I call a class clown, to make people laugh. And the reason is because laughter is a hack into courage and into perseverance, into a lot of the other attributes. Because when we laugh, it's an involuntary response. And in that involuntary response, we're getting juiced with three very powerful chemicals, two neurotransmitters and one hormone. The first neurotransmitter is dopamine, which is, again, we've heard about dopamine. It's kind of this very powerful feel-good chemical. Basically tells us, keep doing this. This is good. Keep going. We get juiced with endorphins, which are our human body's opiates, right? They mask our pain. So endorphins mask our physical pain, again, designed by nature to make us the endurance creatures we are. As you know, as humans living out in the wilds, you know, many, many moons ago, nature had to give us a way that, you know, when it took days and days to finally hunt down what we were trying to find or find shelter, we needed the ability to go for long, long hauls, and endorphins help us do that by masking our pain. It's also those who do like long marathons or races will, you know, it's been referred to as runner's high, you know, where you get a burst of endorphins, you feel great. So you get dopamine, you get endorphins, and then you get this hormone called oxytocin, which you all kind of have heard of. It's called the love hormone. It's a binding chemical between human beings. You know, when we engage in physical touch with another human being, when we acts of kindness between other human beings, it's all oxytocin-producing activities that bind us and bond us as human beings. So we have to realize when we laugh, what you get is involuntary. It's like sneezing. We involuntarily get juiced with all three of those very powerful chemicals. And so it's a hack into keeping on going. It's one of the reasons, by the way, why when people are asked what one of the most important qualities in a partner, in a mate is, most people, man or woman, will say humor, right? Because what you're doing is, if someone can make you laugh, it's a signal. It's kind of a neurological, biological signal that when times are tough, I will help bring you through. I will pull you through, and I will be there. It's very, very powerful. And so we have to honor our class clowns, those people who make us laugh in our teams.
And share
with...
Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, if you can't laugh, we're it's going to be a lot harder.
So share with us, there's a great story in the book during surf torture when you were becoming a SEAL. So tell that story again, because I think it's a great example of the humor.
Yeah, the humor in action. So in SEAL training, in BUDS, they do something called surf torture, which is for your audience. It's basically, you know, they line you up arm in arm down there in the surf zone. This is in Southern California, which those people who aren't from Southern California, they don't know that Southern California water is actually pretty darn cold. People think of it as fairly tropical. It's not. It's pretty cold. So, you know, especially in the winter, let's say it gets down in the 50s. And so they'll have you line up arm in arm, and they'll march you out. You'll march out into the surf zone, your arms linked, and then you'll turn around, and then you will lay back, right? And so you're laying back, and the waves are crashing over you, and then they're receding, and they're crashing over you, and you're receding. And it's the coldest, it's one of the coldest things anybody will ever experience. You get a lot of people quitting during surf torture, because you're in there for what feels like forever. They just keep you in there. And they actually, nowadays, they have stopwatches just to make sure guys aren't getting hypothermia so they can time. But as a student, you don't know that. You're just freezing. And so you get a lot of quitting. And inevitably, at some point during your class, an instructor will drive up onto the beach with a van and get out of the van with a megaphone and say, hey, I have hot chocolate, blankets, and donuts for anybody who quits right now, right? Just kind of the survivor challenge offer, right? And typically, you get a lot of people quitting because it's such a juicy offer when you're freezing the surf zone. They did this to my class. I remember that this happened in my class. We were freezing the surf zone, and the instructor did this. And right immediately, to the guy to my right, immediately yells back. He says, hey, do you have any chocolate glazed donuts? Because if you don't, I ain't quitting. And I remember he said that, and I burst out laughing, and he burst out laughing too. And I remember feeling in that moment, I was like, okay, we're going to be okay. You know, kind of like, oh, this is fun. This is kind of, we'll be fine. And I look to my left, and the guy to my left is like stone-faced. He didn't even hear the joke. He's just lost in his pain. And I said to myself, man, that guy's probably not going to make it. And sure enough, within a minute, that guy got up and quit, right? And so what happened there? Well, what happened was we're sitting there freezing in the surf zone. My buddy makes a joke, right? I laugh without, I mean, it's involuntary. I just laugh. Immediately, I get juiced with dopamine, which is telling me this is good. Keep doing this. I get juiced with endorphins, which is telling me this doesn't feel as bad. You know, it doesn't feel that bad at all, right? And then I get juiced with oxytocin. Hey, he and I are in this together. We're bonded. We're I'm not alone here. We're together on this. So it's an incredible hack. I mean, and again, any one of us can think of times in our lives where we've been down, we've been in trouble, we've had it. Just it hasn't been the best situation. We haven't been feeling good, and someone's made us laugh, and suddenly we feel better. Okay, I mean, we have cancer survivors by the thousands who will report, hey, during my treatment, I would just find ways to keep on laughing. I'd watch funny things. I mean, laughter is literally the best medicine, you know, because it's juicing us with some very natural, powerful chemicals.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know that you consult with a lot of businesses on leadership development and working with the high performance teams. And should business teams and maybe even SEAL teams too have diversity in their members' attributes? Or is there a time when a less diverse group could be more effective?
Well, you know, we really have to think about diversity. I think most of the time, diverse groups are going to be the most powerful as long as the team is still cognizant of the attributes required. So the way I think about diversity is it's really diversity of attributes, diversity of skills, and diversity of perspectives. Okay. Now, in the context of that, you still have a set of attributes that's going to be required for a team, right? Again, I mean, I don't know there are certain teams, like a SEAL team might not need a preponderance of empathy in terms of attributes. Okay. We certainly need empathy because you don't want to be unempathetic, but it's not something you need a preponderance of in terms of your members. Okay. So you don't need someone who's like deeply empathetic on the SEAL team. Okay. So it has to be congruent with what those attributes are. But ultimately you can't have a preponderance of all of the attributes. And what I say is all of us have all of the attributes, okay. The difference in each one of us, the levels to which we have each. So I'm like a level 8 out of 10 on adaptability, which means when the environment changes outside my control around me, it's very easy for me to go with the flow, right? Roll with it, right? Someone else might be a level 3, which means the same thing happens to them. It's not very easy for them to go with the flow. It's difficult. It's hard. It's painful. They're still adaptable because human beings are, but they're just not as adaptable. Okay. That goes with all of our attributes, and we show up with different levels of each attribute. So when you put together a list of attributes that's required for teams, for a team, right, it's highly unlikely that you'll find members with all of everyone that you need, which is where you have to start saying, okay, this is where the team actually comes into play, because now we can get different team members that bring different attributes that basically zipper together to make the effective team into a kind of a unit. So this is where someone with patience and someone with impatience can be very effective on a team. Someone with competitiveness and with non-competitiveness can be very effective on a team. This is how those attributes sit together. And I think the same thing goes with skills. Listen, that the quarterback has skills that the lineman might not have, right? But they zipper together beautifully to make a team. So diversity means diversity of skills, diversity of attributes, and of course, diversity of perspective, because when you're talking about teams that can deal with complexity, which are environments that are unpredictable, you don't know what's coming. The more perspectives that you have on a team, the more your optic is opened up for different things you can do, because you have different people, different perspectives, and say, you know what, I have something that I've learned, I know that I can apply to this problem that someone else might not have because of their perspective. So I think diversity in that way is very important. We just have to think of it in terms of attributes, skills, and perspective versus, you know, just kind of putting seats in bodies and, you know, kind of the very, surface level of some of those diversity arguments we've seen, you know, because again, if you do attributes, skills, and perspective, you still will have a very diverse looking team, but it'll be the right kind of diverse in terms of how it to function as a team.
And when you're looking for that optimal team, you know, it came to mind, if attributes are more visible during this uncertainty that you talk about, obviously on a SEAL team training, you can create uncertainty. But how do you create a situation in a business interview or maybe a performance appraisal or some evaluative process to see how someone might react during that uncertainty?
Yeah, so the first, it's a great question. The first thing to do is to understand what attributes you're looking for. Okay, because if you don't understand that, then you'll be lost, right? You won't know what to do. The second thing you need to do is you need to throw in some complexity, some uncertainty. Now, you can't. The first requirement is to protract the interview process, right? You don't learn very much by just an interview where you sit down across the table with someone and ask them questions. You just don't. So putting them in different environments will help show some different attributes. Okay. But you know, an example I give oftentimes is kind of a salesperson. If you and I decided we wanted to hire a salesperson or someone who's good at sales, we could tell that person on a Friday, we say, "Hey, come in Tuesday morning and you're going to sell us this pencil." Okay. And then you and I show up Tuesday morning, the person shows up Tuesday morning, they proceed to blow our minds with the level of presentation, sales presentation they're able to give us on that pencil. Now, the problem is you and I would not have learned very much. All we would have learned is that this person is very good at preparing a presentation and giving a presentation. Okay. So instead, what we might do is we say on Friday, Tuesday, show up, you're going to sell us this pencil. And then on Tuesday morning, when they show up, we say, "Hey, the plan has changed. You're no longer selling us this pencil. You're going to sell us this, whatever, this coffee mug." Okay. Now, at that point, you and I have to make a decision, a very deliberate decision, to divorce ourselves from skills assessment. Okay. Because what we're about to see is probably going to look ugly and not very pretty, right? Because we're going to see this person and how they react. Okay. But now we're looking at attributes. Okay, how does this person react? Are they humorous? Do they go with the flow? Are they adaptable? Do they kind of joke about it? Do they do the best? I mean, how do they perform? Or are they kicking the dirt? Are they complaining? Are they making excuses? Do they kind of spiral into kind of despair? Okay, that's when we start understanding, hey, now I'm looking at attributes. And the idea is if you understand the attributes you're looking for, and you find the attributes in the person that you need, you can pretty much teach them any skill you want to teach them. And that's something we used to say. There's an old rumor. There's a couple of rumors around this. So when you hear different stories, like 20 different stories of the same flavor, you kind of conclude that at least it has to have happened once or twice, right? But a story of a guy who showed up at SEAL training, and one of the things you had to do back then is you had to kind of do a 50-meter swim across the pool just to make sure you were comfortable in the water. Well, this kid shows up and he jumps into the water, sinks immediately to the bottom, and then proceeds just to kind of walk across the bottom to the other side of the pool. He comes up and the instructor's like, "What the hell were you doing?" And the kid says, "Well, I'm sorry, instructor, I don't know how to swim." And the instructor says, "Oh, shoot, we can teach you how to swim. You're good, right?" And it's a great story because it's an example of the fact that we can always teach you the skill. But if you had enough of the attributes that you would show up and you'd walk underwater just because you wanted to be there, that's the kind of person we want, because we can teach you any skill. We can teach you how to shoot all day long. We teach you how to scuba dive. We teach you how to swim. It's about the attributes. If you find the right attributes, you can teach any skill you want.
Yeah, that's great. So I would assume that a lot of what your business consulting is now is to help leaders identify those attributes and then find them within the people they're looking for to build their teams.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And I help them with that process of figuring out what those attributes that they're looking for, get that list going, and then start to examine our current teams and saying, "Hey, what does our current team look like?" Because there might be someone who's underperforming, but they're underperforming because they're not positioned in a place where that's kind of playing to their attributes in a great way. So it can help us reposition responsibly, but then it can help us kind of understand our gaps. And now we know exactly what we need to hire for. So, okay, we need some more open-mindedness on this team, or we need some more adaptability. Let's hire someone who has those attributes that can bring those attributes to the team and make it better.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Rich, usually at this point in the interview, I always ask my guests this common question. And that question is, what pearl of wisdom can you leave us with today?
Oh, wow. Let's see. The one I've been thinking about recently is this idea that I always kind of try to say, when you're in the conduct of a goal, any goal you have, it's important to be resolute in the outcome, but be flexible in the approach, right? And so what that means is, you know, so just take a rock climber example. The rock climber looks at the face of the cliff and says, "Of course, the top, I want to go to the top. That's the goal." Okay. And then maybe maps out a general plan on which he or she's going to kind of go up that rock. But it's only when they begin climbing that they actually start to understand the rock intimately, and they start to realize that their original plan is going to have to change, okay? Because what they originally saw wasn't what they thought, and the footholds and the handholds that they thought they saw aren't actually there. So they're going to have to start moving around that rock based on what they're seeing in the moment. So it's very rare that the the plan that we have initially to get to an objective is exactly going to be the plan that we execute along the way. So, but we just have to make sure we're resolute in the outcome and just flexible and adaptable in the approach. Adaptability is a huge one. That's what I leave for people.
Well, thank you, Rich. That's well said. And we could go on for hours and hours talking. I've really enjoyed this discussion. And I really enjoyed the book. I thought the book was well written and really brought up some great points. And I know you didn't pay me to give you a plug here, but I would highly recommend people listening to this get the book. It's really worth reading. So thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Your insight and your ideas on helping business leaders from your experience as a SEAL team member and whatever is really, really insightful. So thanks so much for your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me. And just a quick plug, if people want to find out more about the book, they can go to theattributes.com. And we do have an assessment, a free assessment people can take on the website. They can figure out where they stand on at least three of the categories of attributes. So you can check that out. That's for free. But thanks so much for having me and appreciate the conversation.
Okay. Rich, take care.
All right.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. To listen to all my interviews, subscribe to Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and many other popular podcast platforms. Some of these interviews are on video, and you can search YouTube for Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also access the entire library of interviews on my website, orange.coaching.com, and that is orange.coaching.com, and go to the Media Center and click on Podcasts or Video Gallery. You can also enter the website from pilpodcast.com.